Welcome to Salty Moms Gone Sober. Whether you are a sober, curious, salty individual, can't seem to stay on the wagon, or have some successful sober time under your belt, our podcast creates a safe and comfortable space to let it all out. We can't guarantee anything but a good time and chill vibes. With a dash of humor, genuine language of the heart, and a salty truth throat punch here and there, connect with us on this unpredictable wave of sobriety. And when we find ourselves choking on a mouthful of saltiness, let's stop waiting to exhale and just spit some truth. Without further ado, your hosts, Alyssa Gruskin and Bree Juarez.
Hey guys, Alyssa here. Welcome to another episode of Salty Moms Gone Sober.
Hey guys, Bree here. Thank you so much for tuning in this evening. We have a very exciting guest representing Richmond, Virginia. Alyssa, would you like to introduce him?
Yes, I would love to. So tonight we have a really awesome guy here who's going to share his story. His name's Jake Chaney, and we're just super excited and blessed that you're able to be here tonight with us.
So if you want to go ahead, Jake. Take it away.
Thanks, guys. Really happy to be here. Yep. So I'm from the east end of Henrico County, right outside of Richmond and Highland Springs. It's cool that I get to do this and talk about some stuff that I normally wouldn't talk about in other company. So I got clean in 2009. My sobriety date's April 22nd, 2009. I grew up, both of my parents were together. I have a brother who's like 15 months older than me. Like I said, we grew up in Highland Springs, and it's a pretty cool place to grow up. But most of the kids I grew up with were like knuckleheads. You know, we stole bikes, stole cigarettes from our parents, would sneak off in the woods, get in fights, all that cool stuff. But I also went to talented and gifted classes. They told me when I was in like second grade that I needed to go to talented and gifted classes. And so that automatically made me like a nerd to all the knucklehead kids that I hung out with in the neighborhood and my older cousins. And then when I went to the new school, I went to Jacob L. Adams, where they had a couple of tag classes. It was like pilot program for elementary schools in Henrico County. They all thought I was the knucklehead. You know, I got in fights on, on the playground and stuff, but I always felt like I never really fit in. When I was, like I said, when I was with the smart kids, I was a knucklehead. When I was with the knuckleheads, I was a nerd. And I also had like, I was a very sensitive kid. My brother and my older cousins would like haze me. They would like, pick on me all the time. And I would cry, and they were trying to toughen me up, So I would say when I got into like seventh and eighth grade is really when I started to explore with drug use. I started smoking pot. And I think the first time I drank, I was in eighth grade. This older kid had a fake ID. His name was Bill. He used to call me Whitey. He was like a 17-year-old kid with a fake ID hanging out with like 13-year-old kids, which was super creepy now that I think about it. But back then, I didn't really see anything wrong with it. Actually, I thought it was kind of cool. He went to the store, got me a deuce-deuce of St. Ides, and that was my first drink. I don't think like I was an alcoholic from the beginning. I know that I did it. It was a form of escapism and to kind of feel like I was a part of the group. And that's what it did for me. I didn't really fall in love. I mean, I was addicted to cigarettes really early. I started stealing cigarettes and got addicted to cigarettes when I was like 13, 14. But I didn't really get addicted to any like really psychoactive drugs until I was 18 years old. I was like hanging out with kind of a rough group anyway. We all carried guns. We weren't selling drugs at that point, but later on we all sold drugs. We all carried guns. We all had kind of this weird morbid obsession with gun violence. And I remember my cousin, if he ever finds this podcast, I hope he hears that I have to say this, pure sociopath. He hands me a baseball bat and he's like, let's bat fight. And he has this other bat in his hand and he swings this bat, and breaks my index finger knuckle on my right hand. And I don't know, it crushed my knuckle. And I went to the doctor, and the doctor gave me a prescription for Loratap. And I remember the first time that I did, like, the first time I ate a Loratap, I took three at a time. And then, like, an hour later, I took three more. And I sat in my bedroom, the lights off, and I played video games, and I listened to music. And I just remember feeling like, this is the best feeling I've ever had in my entire life. I felt, like, all warm and fuzzy on the inside. I felt like I could sit at home in a room by myself, perfect peace and ease. And that rattling off that happened in my head on a regular basis just stopped. It was quiet. I know that when I was around people, when I wasn't clean, when I wasn't sober, there was always this thing going off in my head of like, I didn't feel like I deserved to be around the people I was around. I didn't know how I was supposed to act. I thought that everybody was like looking at me and judging me at all times. And like the reality of the situation is most people aren't paying attention to what I'm doing, right? Like they're paying attention to what they're doing. But I just remember being so self-absorbed that I thought everybody was looking at me and I was obsessed with this. But when I did Loratabs, Vicodin, whatever you want to call it, hydrocodone, all of that drifted away. And I was like, I want to do this all the time. So I chased that for a long time. I sold my prescriptions. I found Coke as a party drug. Like I did and sold a lot of Coke during this time of my life. I would stay up all night partying with friends. I would come home, I would crash out for like 6 hours during the day, and I would wake up and like I walked everywhere because I never got a driver's license. So I would be with friends like doing big ass lines of coke on the railroad tracks. And we thought it was hilarious. We're like, we're doing a rail on the rail. It was so pitiful. Like when I look back at it, how pathetic that was. It's just because I'm like walking. I'm a grown man. I'm like 19, 20 years old. No driver's license, no car. Walking to a friend's house so we could party all night. And a lot of that gun violence came back to kind of, it reared its ugly head in my life. I have, like I said, I have a brother, my younger cousin and him, they got into a shootout with some drug dealers in a pretty bad part of town, and they went to prison, and I was doing a lot of the same stuff with them. I used to drive them to these attempted robberies. I would participate in that kind of stuff. And I've heard a lot of people, you know, along the way in my partying. I don't know how graphic you guys want me to be, but I remember one night I was at a friend's house, and we were partying, playing poker, and we were doing coke and we were drinking whiskey and playing poker all night. And I went out, all my money was gone, and my cousin was there, he was still playing, all of the coke was gone, and all that was left was whiskey, and they're playing cards. And I just remember getting like progressively angry through the night. Like I wanted this night to be over. The sun started coming up, the birds started chirping, and it was just an awful feeling. I was like, man, this is terrible. I want to leave. My cousin is probably one of the most annoying people on the face of the earth. He's calling people like, I don't even know how to, like gay slurs. And one guy says like, you call me that again, I'm going to, you know, beat your ass. And then another guy's like, if you beat his ass, I'm going to jump in and help you. And this is my cousin. And like I said, we all carried knives, guns. I had a trench knife. And I was like, look, man, if he starts beating his ass and you try to jump in, I got no choice but to crack your head open with this trench knife. And it's like it almost happened exactly like that. I'm not going to get into too many details about that because I'm not sure what the statute of limitations are on any of this stuff. But I just remember there was a lot of blood, people hurt, and I was a cause of it. And there's a lot of traumatic stuff that happened, and it all centered around my drinking and drugs. See, you guys know me. You've probably seen me quite a bit. And I think most people who know me now would agree that I don't strike them as like an angry, violent type of person. And deep down, I don't think I am. But I drink and I use drugs to kind of afford me this reputation in order, like, to enable me to turn into somebody different, somebody that I couldn't be without it. And a lot of my violence centers around that, like drinking and using drugs that allowed me to be violent and to hurt people in this world because I had to adapt in my environment. And I did a lot. I did a lot of adapting. One night after my brother and my cousin went to prison, I had gotten a house with a couple of roommates, and me and a buddy of mine were drinking and watching a football game. And one of my roommates took the other roommate's shotgun in the backyard and put it to his chest and pulled the trigger. And my friend who were watching the football game, we found him, and he ended up surviving that. But he died in front of us and died two more times, I believe, when they were taking him to the hospital. And then they were able to do like emergency surgery on him. But I remember that traumatic, like, I'm pretty sure I have PTSD from it. It's undiagnosed. But when that happened, my love for opiates, see, I kind of took a break in between there. When I turned 21, I loved drinking. Like, I would go party. I went to Beach Week. We spent like an entire like year and a half just drinking and partying and hanging out with friends and girls. And I sold weed and, you know, stuff like that. But I would say that didn't last very long. I'd say about 8 months after that, I was right back to opiates, and it would progress every single time. It went from Lortabs to, you know, to Oxycontin, and then eventually to heroin. And it started off just sniffing heroin and sniffing coke, and all that stuff was cool because I was selling coke. You know, I would use these little tricks to tell myself that I'm not that bad. You know, like I'm selling coke, so, you know, I could do a little bit of coke. Or, and then, I mean, eventually I'm like full on smoking crack, shooting up heroin. But I didn't start shooting heroin and smoking crack until that traumatic situation, right? And what I know now is that, like, the traumatic situation, the traumatic response, the trauma response that I had, it really could have been any trauma that I experienced. Me as an addict and an alcoholic, I will look for any excuse to just burn it all to the ground. I go through these cycles where things will get bad enough where it's like a catalyst. It wakes me up and it tells me I need to change my life. Something's got to change. It wasn't until I got sober with 12 steps to understand that it's like the first drink is what I needed to avoid. Back then it was like, I need to change the people I'm hanging out with. I need to get a house. I need to get a new job. I need to find a better girlfriend, or, you know, whatever the new thing is for me, the thing that I think is going to fix me. And I would do that. I would clean up for a while, and I would seek out whatever that thing is that I think is going to fix me. And then a good idea would snap into my head. I've done great for like 8 months. I deserve to go out drinking. And I would go out drinking and I would black out. And I would do something completely embarrassing, something I would be ashamed of. And then after that, I would start justifying going back to opiates and smoking crack. And it would take me about 4 months, 4 months of that. And I would end up in the Legacy Inn off of Williamsburg Road. And I always get choked up about it because it was something that I thought I was just going to be doomed. Like, this is going to be my life. You know, like, I didn't think that there was any making it out of that. I thought it was, this is going to be my pattern for the rest of my life. And I would end up in this motel and I would want to kill myself every single time. I would look in the mirror and I'd think, how the hell did I get here? I used to, right before I got clean, I lived in this motel. I had a shotgun loaded beside my bed. I thought that there were cameras in the little remote control sensor on the TV. I thought that the feds had my phone tapped. I would kind of wear a little path in the carpet back and forth from the bathroom to the peephole and just walk back and forth and back and forth because I was paranoid. And I had this one friend, the same friend that was there watching football with me when my roommate shot himself. That guy has stuck with me for like through it all. He's like the one person that never left me no matter what was going on. He's watched me through the whole thing. So shout out to Mike Howard. Really appreciate that guy. But I remember I didn't want him around me because I was ashamed of what I was doing. He came over one time and I like bit, you know, the fiberglass filter out of a cigarette because I was going to go use it to shoot up. And I looked at him and told him not to judge me. And I don't think at that point he knew because he saw what he wanted to see. But I was so ashamed of what I was doing. And eventually, so I used to get high and watch Intervention. And I would see people on there who were doing the exact same stuff I was doing, right? Like I knew the feeling of being dope sick. I knew the hustle of like going and stealing DVD sets from Walmart and then taking them back to GameStop and then, you know, getting the money to get our fix. Like I would see people doing the exact same stuff that I was doing, felt the exact same way that I was feeling, had the same schemes and all of that stuff. And then, you know, their parents or whoever loved them would like put some pressure on them to go get some help. And I remember like selfishly thinking like, why isn't my family doing this for me? But anyway, at the end of it, you know, they do like the 30-day or 90-day check-in where they come back and they talk to the people and it was something different. I don't know how to describe it. They were happy. There was a light behind their eyes. Something was going on in their life where I saw a glimmer of hope. I saw that these people who felt exactly like I felt, who were doing the same exact stuff that I did, they were doing something different. And they didn't seem miserable. They seemed happy. And I was like, I knew I was going to die. Right. Because I saw my brother, I saw my cousin go to prison. I started seeing friends of mine die from overdoses. People were dropping dead all around me. It was terrifying. And I just knew that death was the next step for me. Like I had no problems believing that it was like a life or death situation. And so I was like, I guess I should try to find some help. And I tried to call the little phone number or website or, you know, follow the website at the end of Intervention. And that didn't really get me anywhere. But what did was talking to guys that I was getting high with, they all told, like two or three guys told me about the Healing Place over in Southside. And I'm just going to do a kind of a shameless plug here. If you're in like the Southeast or Mid-Atlantic area and you need help, whether you're a guy or a girl, look for the Healing Place. Hands down, saved my life. And I've seen it save a lot of people's lives. It's free. They were telling me like, it's free. You get a bed, you get three hot meals, the food's good and the people are nice, right? I didn't know that I wanted to like completely give everything up. I just knew that whatever I was doing like was going to kill me. So I needed to try to do something different. So I packed all my stuff up into a trash bag and I got to hoofing it. I got a couple of rides on the way. People saw me walking with like this trash bag and a dirty clothes hamper full of my stuff. And they took pity on me and gave me a ride. My aunt let me drop my stuff off in her like in her shed, and she gave me a ride the rest of the way. And she gave me a cigarette and said good luck. So I got to 700 Dinwiddie Avenue, the Healing Place. It's a men's facility, but they also have a new women's facility, which is amazing. They dropped me off. I walked in the door and I went into their detox. And almost immediately when I got into detox, so what they do is 24 hours, you detox, you don't go to a meeting. They let you eat and stuff. Obviously you eat, you sleep and then the next day somebody will come talk to you and then you get to go to meeting. But that first 24 hours, I immediately started planning my relapse immediately because I am a drug addict and an alcoholic, and left to my own devices without any other kind of solution, my immediate knee-jerk reaction is to think how I can not be clean and sober and present, right? Like I need to find something that's going to take me out of what's going on right here now, because I, without a solution, I'm so uncomfortable, ashamed, afraid, resentful, all of that stuff, that I just can't stand it. I can't, I can't be present without it. So the first meeting I go to, see, I didn't know that then, but the first meeting I went to, I was honest about what was going on in my life, right? Like how I was living my life, because I was like picking the cleanest dirty clothes out of my trash bag full of dirty clothes. When I was thirsty, so I had gotten food from Burger King, but I saved the cup, right? Because I could walk back and forth and get a refill. So I have something, you know, I'd have some free drink, and I would walk to Wawa and I would steal food. And then all of my unemployment money went to get high, and it was gone in like a day. Almost immediately, all that money's completely gone. And then I would con my mom out of money to pay for my room until I ran out of unemployment. And then I had to do something different. But I was honest with those guys about what was going on, and that I just kind of, I'd run out of answers. I didn't know what I was doing. And that was kind of the first time in my life that I was able to admit that I had no idea what I was doing. I don't know how to live life. I don't know where to go from here. I just keep ending up in the same place over and over and over again. And one guy shared his story, and he talked about his drinking, his detox, but he talked about the pain and suffering that he experienced. And it was something that I understood. It was, I believed him. There was something in the sincerity and the conviction in his tone and in his voice that helped me to understand this guy knew what he was talking about. And then he started talking about what his life was like then. He talked about having a relationship with his family, he talked about having a career, and he talked about like generally and genuinely being content with his life. And right there, I made a decision that I don't know what these people are doing here, but I'm making a commitment right now that if I wake up tomorrow, I'm going to do what it is that they're doing here. And I'm going to do that to the best of my ability, because I was afraid that maybe it wouldn't work for me. I would do all the work and then it still wouldn't work and I would die. But you know, I dove in head first, and I picked a 12-step fellowship that I wanted to be a part of. And I got into a group in that fellowship, and I started doing service work, and I started working the steps with a sponsor, and all of that stuff was super uncomfortable, but it was necessary, because I knew that if I didn't do it, I was going to die. I mean, just real quick, I don't want to take up too much more time, but I want to say that the things that have worked for me, the things that have been consistent in my life over the past 13 years, a home group, a job in that home group, a sponsor where I'm actively working steps and making myself available to be of service, whatever that looks like, right? Like wherever I was in my sobriety, I always made myself available, whether that's on a committee to put on a conference, or it's writing, you know, writing bylaws for a committee, or just being a part of a home group, making coffee or making sure the doors are open, getting literature, all that stuff. It's looked different over the course of the past 13 years, but it's always been consistent that I've been available to be of service, sponsoring guys, opening meetings, being kind of in the center of the fellowship that I chose. And what my life is like today, like when I first got here, I wanted to kill myself. I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't pay for insurance. I was unemployable. I hadn't had a single relationship in my life last longer than like 3 months. And I'm married to one of the most wonderful human beings on the face of the earth. We have a beautiful daughter. I have a son from a prior marriage. I have a career, and all sorts of messed up things have happened in my life. I lost my mom to cancer 3 years ago. I've gone through a divorce. I've been fired from jobs. I've been laid off from jobs. I've also had some like really cool things happen, like the birth of my son and being married to the woman that I'm married to now, and getting to meet my niece. That's actually a funny story that I do want to tell real quick. All right. So my brother was in prison. He got out of prison about 2 or 3 months before I moved to Seattle. I got a promotion working for Amazon. Started off as a warehouse worker, started moving up. I got a promotion to work in a corporate office in Seattle. Furthest I had moved away from Richmond, Virginia. Like I had never lived more than 15 minutes outside of the city of Richmond my entire life. And then I moved 3,000 miles away to take this corporate job. I moved out there. My wife and son stayed here. That wasn't the plan, but I'm not going to get into that. So I went out there and my brother started seeing a girl. I never met her. Apparently, he started hanging out with guys that he was in prison with and doing some not so good stuff. And I got a phone call one day that I needed to check headlines. My brother made like national headlines when he went back to prison. Some really messed up stuff. I'm not going to tell his story, but I hadn't talked to him in 8 years up until a couple of weeks ago as a result of the stuff that he did that sent him back. And I moved back to Richmond to try to save that marriage. That didn't work out. And so I went right back into working, doing what I, you know, consistently do everywhere. I started sponsoring a guy and we were sitting down to coffee at Crossroads Coffee Shop. And it's like the get to know each other phase. Even though I knew him before, like I knew of him before I went to Seattle, he had asked me to sponsor him. We're sitting down to coffee and we're getting to know each other. And he starts telling me about his daughter. And he says his daughter has a little sister and that the little sister isn't his, but the little sister's father is in prison and he's in prison because X, Y, and Z. And he basically verbatim tells me my brother's story. Right. So I pull out a picture of my brother and I show it to him. And he says, yeah, that's Tessa's dad. Right. So nobody told me that I had a niece, but because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of working steps with a sponsee, like I found out that I have a niece. And now I get to have this really cool relationship with her. I'm in her life, and that guy didn't make it. He died of an overdose about a year later. And so not only do I get to be a part of my brother's daughter's life, I get to be a part of his daughter's life. And it's just weird how this stuff works out the way it does. So really, I think that's it. I think I'm done.
Well, Jake, thank you very much for telling us that part of your journey that you went on in your life, because, you know, we have heard your story before, but from a little bit of a different point of view and not as in depth with some of the drugs and other behavior that you were involved in. And it really refreshing to hear you still have that conviction and compassion and in your voice when you talk about those experiences. It still affects you as a human being, right? Oh, yeah. And our guests can't see you, but you can hear it all over you and are coming from your mouth. And like, that is true language of the heart and something that you can't make that shit up, you know?
It's something I never want to lose either. If you guys hear me share my story and you hear me lose that, it's one of the things that keeps me in recovery is when I share my experience with other people, I get to feel that stuff over again. I can't do that like going through my everyday life. I get road rage. I'm thinking about bills. I'm thinking about stuff with my ex-wife. I'm thinking about work. I'm thinking about everything except for that experience. And I show up to hang out with you guys, talk to your listeners and other people in recovery so I can share my experience and feel that again. I don't get it anywhere else. It's something about it that changes.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a service is a constant reminder of humility and staying humble. Because when you do sit down with like a newcomer and you do talk about your story or you're in a meeting and telling your story, it's like, damn, like I need to keep doing this because I can never forget where I came from. Because if I forget where I came from, then I'm going to forget where I never want to be again. And that's just priceless, you know?
It's odd to think of how easy it is to forget it because it's such a jarring and traumatic and huge part of my life, but you know, I just forget it like that. And I think that is the condition, you know, like that's the fatal condition that I can't bring it into my consciousness with sufficient force unless I'm talking to y'all.
Yeah. With like-minded people that, and then allowing other like-minded people to hear the true darkness of your reality that you lived, because so many other people are living these kind of realities and think that they might be the only ones, or they don't know where to go for help. You know, you mentioned like you think you might have some PTSD from your best friend putting a shotgun to his chest in the backyard and pulling the trigger. I'm pretty sure you're correct about that thought of having some PTSD about that. Not everybody lives a lifestyle where something like that happens on a regular basis, or carry guns, like not only the drugs and alcohol, but the violence that came along with it. And like you even said so yourself, like the alcohol and drugs made it so you could be that new Jake, like the Jake that could say, fuck you, like I'm gonna beat you over the head with this fucking trench knife right now, and like I don't give a fuck what the consequences are. And you wouldn't do that if you didn't have this persona going on that was provided by drugs and alcohol, and because that's just not the kind of person that you are. Do you remember like that, the power and the force of that, like going into that other person and what you were thinking?
So a lot of times my blackouts, came from, and I can place it. Not only is it the alcohol, but it was the adrenaline rush from some wild, violent thing that I was doing while drunk. I was not that drunk in this particular case, so I do remember it, but it was also, a lot of, adrenaline. The first one bounced off his head and I had to hit him again. I remember it. And then I remember his blood being all over me, and it was terrible. It wasn't.
Did you feel gratification in that moment because you defended your people?
When it happened initially, yes, like as the action was happening, but then comes the sober realization when you see the outcome of like, oh, I just did this to another human being, you know, like it's like, what did I just do? And that's happened more than once. The problem is if you live that lifestyle and it happens enough and it's now normalized, or you become desensitized. So I've seen a lot of things that, that I started to become desensitized to, but I think I never made it all the way there. Like I'm definitely not a sociopath. Like I felt bad for every time I hurt somebody. And I was always taken aback by the aftermath of it. There were people that I hung out with that just were not fazed, and in fact were probably pretty amused by hurting other people.
Even proud.
So I'm not going to speak on that. Yeah, I'm not going
to. Okay.
Because I wasn't there. I can't really rightfully talk about something that's not my like direct experience, but
yeah. But I just know that when you're like defending like your people, like there is a sense of pride. Like that's why people are in like gangs and why people come together, you know, and you have a sense of like togetherness, and there is a sense of pride when you're defending your people, you know, whether it's right or wrong. Like these are the people that are going to have your back, so you're going to have their back too. And not saying that any of it's right, but like you said, the longer you live that lifestyle, the longer, or the more in someone's mind, it does become right. Mm-hmm. Like that's the right thing to do.
Yeah. So in that situation, he was my cousin. Like I'm operating from like this dude's my family. And I'm not going to let my family get jumped while I'm just going to stand there and watch. And I also justified it by saying I gave this guy a fair warning. Like I told him what was going to happen and he did it. And like I stuck to my word. But I don't think that in that case I was like proud, like in kind of a I protected my people. Because honestly, I don't really have that kind of relationship with my cousin. My cousin, like I said, is a bit of a sociopath and not a great dude. Mm-hmm. The way he treated people, like I honestly, in that situation, I felt like he deserved this ass whooping that he's about to get. But I can't let him get jumped, right? Like there's this like stupid street code where it's like you cannot let one of your people get jumped. If it's a fair fight, you just stand back. And I was really hoping that it was just going to be them two going at it. My cousin gets his ass whooped and we could be like, hey, you should have shut your mouth. You know, you shouldn't be running your mouth to people. And that's just not how it went. And it's one of those things that I wish I could make amends. Mm-hmm. Like I really wish I would see that guy and I would be able to say the right words to make it right. But I know that that's probably not something that's ever going to happen. And it's probably something that would cause more harm to him if I brought it back up.
So my point with saying that was really more so to kind of connect with some of our listeners that might be stuck in that kind of situation, you know, where they're like, how the fuck do I get out of this? Like the way that you didn't really want to do what you did. You did it because you felt like you had to, because it was your cousin, it was your family, you know, but that didn't keep going and going and going. I mean, it may have gone a couple of times, but like it didn't become your real lifestyle. And some of our listeners, it's their real lifestyle and they don't want to be in that kind of lifestyle.
I was super blessed to have most of those people go to prison. I know that most people will not have that grace. I was able to kind of break ties to the people around me that had that kind of influence. And like, namely my brother, my cousin, and I was able to go take care of myself for a long period of time before I was kind of reintroduced to them. And I think that like for most people who are in those situations, I would look at who I think is probably the most influential person in my life that kind of leads me in that direction, and create as much space as humanly possible, right? Like in those cases, like I normally don't advocate a geographical change, but some people need that geographical change. Like I didn't make that because I had the grace of being apart from a lot of the people that I ran with and did harm to people with.
So when your cousin and your brother were in prison and you kind of found yourself like with this, it, like you mentioned, like kind of like a 4 month cycle, like you would be like, okay. And then you'd be like, I deserve to go out and have a night of drinking. And it would lead to drugs and, you know, reintroducing opiates and suicidal ideation, not even just suicidal ideation, but you had the fucking shotgun right next to you. I mean, it was, it was, I mean, the choice of a second of it happening, you know, and like, and ending up at the Legacy Inn and every, like, it was like this 4 month cycle, you know, and did you do that in isolation while they were in prison? Is that like what you did with your time? Is that kind of like the time frame?
So there were other people, kind of like fair weather friends that were around. And then there were like low bottom friends among, kind of like speckled throughout the friend circle.
The bottom feeders, Alyssa. Yeah, so, your favorite.
So I would hang out with the fair weather friends when things were going great and we would go out drinking. And then I would start blacking out and doing crazy shit. And people would be like, man, you need to, you know, you need to chill out. And then that's when I knew it was time to like hit up the low bottom, because like that's really where. That's where I lived. I've been so blessed to see quite a few of them come in and, you know, try to get their stuff straight. And that's been cool. Some of them, you know, haven't been successful yet, but like saving a seat for them and the seed has been planted and stuff. But yeah, so my cycle, it was kind of with the same group of friends, just minus the element of constant violence, criminal behavior. So
right, which was a big influence of your cousin and your brother, right?
Yeah, but it also caused a lot of terror, because when they were around, I ran with them, so I kind of was afforded this reputation that came with them. I mean, I also did things to kind of like push myself into that. And then when they were gone, I was just by myself. And I still had the reputation, but we had hurt a lot of people. And there were a lot of people who were not very happy with me. And I was... That's part of the reason why I was so paranoid. Also, I had a few bad rolls on ecstasy. So I think that changed my brain the way I was super paranoid one time. I thought like shadow people were ducking behind cars and like gonna murder me and stuff. So
following you. It follows. Yeah,
they were following me conscience. For sure. But I was super paranoid because of all the people I hurt. And now I just know it was shame and remorse. And my conscience was just telling me that like this was the other shoe was gonna drop. So I was terrified all the time. I didn't have my protection system, which was the violence of a brother and a cousin who just like didn't care about hurting people. It was kind of a mess.
And then you found the healing place.
Yeah.
And even when you went to the healing place, you said to yourself, like you had so much fear that I'm not gonna stay here. I'm already planning my relapse, because what's gonna happen is that I'm gonna put in all this work and I'm gonna fail at it. Yeah. Like full of fear. I'm gonna fail. Like what all of us addicts and alcoholics tell ourselves all the time, because I am a fuck up and I'm a failure. And then you heard somebody say the words that you needed to hear, and whether or not that was on intervention or at the healing place.
Yeah, I got that a couple of times.
Yeah. And then you were granted like the true gift of desperation and you were willing to do this.
Yeah, one of those guys that was one of the bottom feeders, him and I used to go get heroin at from a guy who stood outside of a store called the 301 Express.
And it's that's right by
right by the healing place. Exactly,
right by the healing place.
That's right. So yeah. When I went to the healing place, I was right down the street from where I used to get heroin from.
Yeah.
And there was a guy that was in there was a guy that was in detox with me, and he was in detox, but he had already been in the program at the healing. And he had relapsed. He went out, went to I think his sister's house, got some heroin, came back and got high, and he was in his bunk, and they caught him. So they sent him to detox, and him and I were talking, and I was like, yo, I know a guy, he stands at the store right up the street. As soon as they let me out, you know, we can go get, you know, we can go get high. I mean, that's not the words that we said, like, it's a little more street than that. Like, we can go get funky, man. Let's go go up the street. And it was so funny how the first thing that happened before I was able to get on the street was I got to go sit in a meeting, and the grease of that desperation hadn't left. That window is so small, right? Like, I see it in people when they first come in off the street. The window is so small. Mm-hmm. If you're listening to this and you're thinking that you might have a problem, don't wait till tomorrow. Like, because tomorrow doesn't come. Like, tomorrow is too late. Some people don't make it to tomorrow. And if you make it to tomorrow and you're like, oh, I'm going to change my mind, I don't think this is the right thing for me, you might not survive it, right? Like, I see it when people are like, oh, I might go in a couple of days. Like, that was a death sentence for me. If I hadn't have had that meeting at that time and heard those words, I would have walked up to the 301 Express. And I heard stories of a guy who they found in a porta potty 3 blocks from the 301 Express dead. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, it's sad, man. It happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And you took that window of opportunity and you dedicated your time and yourself to this program, particularly at the healing place, because this is a facility that's a little bit different than your normal rehab that you go to. This is a place where men and, thank God, now women can go and learn how to live life in society as a sober, clean person and see other people succeed and see other people graduate out of the program and fail and make a decision. Like, do I want to go left or do I want to go right? Like, which way? Because I'm going to go one way or the other, you know?
Is it cool if I get on a soapbox real quick?
Oh yeah, I love a soapbox.
Okay, cool. So there's kind of this culture around Richmond about the healing place and to like recovery houses and other recovery programs. They kind of like use it as like a punishment. Like, if you don't do good in this program, you got to go to the healing place. Like, that's a terrible thing or something, right? Let me tell you something. Hands down, the best program in the Richmond area is the healing place. If you want to know if you are willing to do whatever it takes to stay clean and sober, go to the healing place. When I was in that program, I wrote, like, you know, the only punishment that you're going to do is you're going to like write words or whatever, right? I wrote like 250,000 words, but I could have died. Like, I don't understand the idea that like having to go to a nine month long program is like a punishment. It's free. It's based on the 12 steps. You don't have to pay a dime. They're not trying to take anything from you. When I was there, I got the sense that it's run by people who are just like you. And they give you this stuff for free 24 hours a day. It is probably one of the safest places to get clean and stay clean. And I just want people to know there's one in Louisville, Kentucky. There's one in Huntington, West Virginia. There's one in Raleigh, North Carolina. There's one here in Richmond, Virginia. If you're near any of those areas and you don't have insurance and you need somewhere to go that's not going to charge you money and will give you the place and the time and all the information you need to get clean and sober, the Healing Place Men, they have men's facilities and women's facilities. Reach out. There will be a bed. There's always availability. I can't say enough for what that program did.
And then even after that, there's transitional living.
Yep. Yeah. They do everything.
It's not just graduate the program and then like, you know how to live life now. Yeah. Good luck. Right. You know, it's like you are encouraged to go to transitional living for a reason. You know, because that it's not easy getting back to or into society when sometimes some of us have been out of it for so long and like might even look for an excuse to go back to the streets or go back to prison because it's 100%. Like, fuck this life shit. This is way too fucking hard for me. Like, I'm not cut out for this shit.
That's right. I burned my life to the ground. And then right before like full on homelessness, I went there. There are people who burn their lives to the ground, become homeless and stay homeless for like extended periods of time. And that becomes their reality. And those people, it's even harder for them because they haven't existed in in society, having a job or, you know, like normal relationships with people, like that stuff is super hard.
Setting up a power bill, getting your name on it. I mean, setting up utilities, like just all of that is so overwhelming. Yep. And it's 100%. Overwhelming, like for anybody, let alone someone who, isn't used to doing all that stuff.
And yeah, I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. I went through the program. I became assistant staff. They call it a peer mentor, but it's really just assistant staff where you work with clients and stuff and help take them through their program. And then you go into transition, and then they even have I know they had alumni houses. I'm not sure if I think most of those alumni houses are situated like in a really nice area over top of the women's facility now. But so even after transition, they have alumni houses. So you could stay there for anywhere from 9 months, which is the program, all the way to like, 5 to 10 years. If that's really what you, I mean, I don't recommend that, but like, if that's what you need to do to transition back to society and get a job and save some money, they help you save money. They have life skills. They teach you how to interview for jobs and write resumes. And, you know, it's very valuable.
In that transitional living and in the alumni living, you're responsible to pay for your room and board. Yep. And you're learning all of those responsibilities to be successful with this program that you've learned.
Yep.
You know, like to carry it with you through life. And like, I cannot advocate for the Healing Place more either. Like, I think that it is just a wonderful opportunity. And of course I didn't go through the Healing Place, but I mean, you guys who are peer mentors and you're there and you're giving your time to these new people that come in there and like your one of those people that told a story to you that made you stay.
People come up to me. People come up to me and they'd be like, man, I remember you used to talk about X, Y, and Z, things that I don't really even discuss anymore. And like, that is super humbling, that there's somebody out there who heard something that I said 10 years ago that gave them their second step moment or their third step moment or whatever that is. You know, that's like, that's not me, because of my own, you know, like of my own power, I hurt people and I steal from people. And I, you know, like I'm not a great dude, except for what AA has taught me and my willingness to stick around and do the work.
Thank you so much for your time and just being one of those people that supports constant service, because you know that it keeps you sober and you're planting a seed. You don't know when it's going to grow, but you're planting a seed.
Yeah, and thanks guys for having me.
Of course. Is there just any last like message that you'd like to say to any of the people struggling out there in silence?
Yeah. If you think that you've heard anything in my story that you can relate to, and you believe that maybe you don't deserve this like I did, try to set that to the side. I want you, whoever it is listening to this, to experience what I have experienced in getting sober. The life-changing experience that I have had here, it comes at a cost. The cost of that is that I convey to other people how much recovery has done. And I cannot express enough how much awesome stuff is in your future if you just set all that to the side and try to do something.
All right. Thank you so much, Jake. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to all our listeners. If you liked what you heard, tune in next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for another episode of Salty Moms Gone Sober. Be there or be square. And in the meantime, stay salty, stay sober, stay sane. Peace.